Welcome to the Fun Time Program. I am your co-host, John Andrew Fredrickson, here with my beautiful co-host,
Vivica Volt.
And we have a wonderful guest on the show today, Dr. Sukrit Ranjan. He is a professor at MIT. Did I get that right, Dr. Ranjan?
I'm a postdoctoral fellow. I was formerly at MIT, now I'm at Northwestern.
Oh wow.
Okay. That's very exciting. So you're a postdoc at Northwestern, and you are one of the authors on the recent paper that was published in Nature magazine about the discovery of phosphine gas on Venus. What is your scientific background, and what led you into this work that enabled you to be a part of this extremely exciting discovery?
Thanks very much, John. So I call myself a planetary photochemist. What that means is I'm interested in the interaction of high energy radiation, like ultraviolet radiation, with molecules. And I'm particularly interested in understanding how this interaction affects life, in particular, the ability of planets to host life and our ability to detect it on those planets as well. So that's kind of my broad research area. Academic background, I don't think anyone... It's not really that important, but I did my PhD in astrophysics at Harvard. I moved on to MIT for a postdoc in planetary science, and I'm kind of staying in the planetary realm of things from there.
So this was at MIT that you were doing this research that was a part of this discovery?
That's correct. I got involved with this particular work at MIT as part of an existing initiative at that institution.
Awesome. And who was the leader at MIT of this particular work?
I got involved with this project through the leadership of Professor Sarah Seeger as part of her All Small Molecules program, which attempts to evaluate a wide range of gases as potential putative biosignatures. My role was primarily to contribute to the photochemical aspects of this work because that's my personal focus area.
What does that mean, photochemical, exactly? How did that contribute to this discovery?
So, there's a few different ways of answering this question, but stepping back a little bit, essentially what that means is I tried to understand what the atmospheres of different rocky planets are made up of and what are the factors that control and affect that. So the idea is, let's suppose you had a source of some gas, like let's say methane or phosphine or something like that on some rocky planet. What I try to do is help calculate how that gas builds up, to what concentrations it can accumulate in the atmosphere of a rocky planet, and how that varies with height, how that varies with altitude. So overall, you can think of it as trying to understand, make predictions and make models of what are the atmospheres of different rocky planets like Earth, Mars, Venus, and planets orbiting other stars made up of.
So why is phosphine gas particularly interesting?
So phosphine gas is a little bit of a weird gas, and it's not interesting at all. Depending on who you talk to, it's not interesting in all environments. It's a very simple molecule in some sense. It consists of a phosphorus atom, one of those fundamental elements, connected to three hydrogens. Mm-hmm. And it's not a very complicated molecule. It's not like DNA or RNA or anything like that. It's very simple, only four atoms. Mm-hmm. And there are some places in the universe you expect to find it very commonly. For example, inside of gas giants, you find a lot of phosphine in the deep, hot interiors of gas giants.
Oh.
And the fundamental reason for that, by gas giants, I mean planets like Jupiter and Saturn, which are giant planets in our solar system, the biggest planets in our solar system, and they're made up almost entirely of hydrogen. They have a ton of hydrogen in them. Because they have a lot of hydrogen there, and in the deep, hot interiors of those planets, if you stick a phosphorus atom there, one of those P's, it tends to bond to those hydrogens. And so it makes phosphine. Mm-hmm. And that's the source of the phosphine we see in the atmospheres of those planets. And it's perfectly normal that we completely understand it. It's completely expected.
So that we see it all the time in the gassy planets, and it doesn't mean that there's life there.
Absolutely not. Yeah. That we know exactly what's causing it. Completely abiotic, very well understood thermodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Awesome. So yeah, what makes it different in Venus? Yeah.
So Venus is a very different planet from Jupiter and Saturn. The biggest difference is that it has very little hydrogen. Its atmosphere instead has, if you were trying to break it down into elements, it really has a lot of oxygen.
Oh.
That oxygen is not free oxygen. It's not O2, the kind of oxygen that you and I and all the other animals here on Earth breathe. It's bonded to other atoms. So what that means is that, for example, carbon on Venus tends to be present primarily in the form of CO2. That's carbon bonded to two oxygens.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, sulfur on Venus similarly tends to be found in the form of SO2 and its derivatives, sulfuric acid, as opposed to bonded to hydrogens. Similarly, you expect to find phosphorus on Venus bonded to oxygens, not to hydrogens. So that's the weird thing about Venus, is finding a significant amount of phosphorus bonded to those three hydrogens instead of oxygens. Now, I want to emphasize that had we even detected phosphate species, that would have been a little wild. We hadn't really considered those in our models of Venus before, although in retrospect, we should have. But the phosphine was a little bit exceptional, because even when we went back and looked at the data from the old Soviet landers and so forth, we couldn't really figure out a way for it to be there at high concentrations. We tried to work out, and 20 parts per billion, which is what we detected, that doesn't sound like a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you look at how unlikely it is to make that phosphorus in Venus's atmosphere, according to the mechanisms that we currently know about, right. And I want to emphasize the depths of our ignorance here.
Right.
that's the weird part. We weren't able to figure out a mechanism yet, that can explain the presence of that phosphine gas in the atmosphere of Venus. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
So what does that mean then?
What that means is that we are very ignorant people. and so what it means is we found something weird and we'd like to understand what's going on. In a sense, this is nothing new. Science is all about finding things that are weird and don't conform to expectations, and then trying to figure out how they're there. And then once you understand it, everyone is like, oh, of course, this is how it should always have been there. I don't understand how those people that came before us could have been so foolish as to never not expect it to be there. Like, computers are super easy to make. I can't figure out, all you need to do is like take some sand and melt it down and do things to the silicon. I can't understand why our ancestors didn't invent them 1,000 years ago.
Right.
So there's a similar thing going on with phosphine over here. We found something weird. We didn't expect it to be there present. We've iterated through the mechanisms we know to look at, like volcanism and lightning and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And those don't seem like very good fits. You have to assume really weird things about the planet in order for those to work. Hmm. So all of them seem to us like the most conservative explanations right now seems to be to rule them out. So we have two options we're left with. The one that I think is most strongly worth focusing on is that there's something going on either with Venus or with the photochemistry, the chemical reactions regarding phosphine that we simply don't understand. And there's a lot of ignorance there. We know very little about the bottom atmosphere of Venus. It's because it's violently hostile to space probes. It tends to melt them. This is bad for getting data.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of unknowns about the lower atmosphere of Venus. And there's actually a lot we don't know about the chemistry of phosphine. That's because phosphine, to a life like ours, oxygen-breathing life, is violently toxic. OSHA frowns upon doing experiments with it unless you have a lot of very expensive equipment and a lot of safety precautions. there really hasn't been a good reason to measure it or characterize those before. There is one other mechanism for phosphine generation that we know of, and we hesitate to reach for it because it's kind of an extremal hypothesis, which is that we do know that here on Earth, phosphine production is associated with life. And this is interesting in the context of Venus in the sense that going back many decades to the foundational papers by Sagan and Morawitz, it has been proposed that the cloud decks of Venus are in some remote sense habitable, in the sense that you have liquid water there and the temperatures and pressures aren't too extreme. Hmm. And we do happen to detect the phosphine at an altitude that is roughly coincident with that, which means that does not mean we've detected life by any means, or even that we've detected convincing evidence of life. It means that life is not yet ruled out as one of the formation mechanisms for phosphine.
Wow, that is so exciting.
That is really fucking cool. So what led you to start looking for phosphines on Venus in general?
Nothing. So there's two teams that were involved with this discovery. One is an observational team that was primarily led in the UK by Dr. Jane Greaves.
Okay.
And the other was a kind of theoretical team that was led here in the United States by Professor Sarah Seeker. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of the two big halves that I'm aware of, that, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And so our team here in the United States, we have this program that was focused on evaluating different potential biosignature gases. Phosphine is one of the gases we looked at. And our conclusion was, if you detect it on a rocky planet, we weren't aware of any false positive mechanism. We weren't aware of any other mechanism that could reasonably generate it in high quantities. But we also concluded that it's super reactive. And we concluded that in order for it to be detectable on a planet orbiting another star, which is what we were focused on at the time, you would need to generate it in such high abundances that it seemed a bit implausible. So our catalog was, might as well look for it, but don't expect to find it.
Does that also mean that you would expect that because it breaks down rapidly, you would expect that if you find it, that means that there is some process that is continuously producing it?
Exactly, yes. And it would, so planets or other stars are very, very far away. So in order to detect phosphine there, you need a ton of it.
Okay.
And you need it emitted at much higher rates than it's emitted here on Earth. So we were like, well, it's promising if you see it, but don't expect to see it. And we definitely wouldn't have expected to see it on any of the bodies in our solar system.
Yeah, just like in our own backyard.
Yeah. So any of the rocky planets anyway.
Right.
So if someone come to us and said, you know, I'm thinking about looking for phosphine on Venus. Is that a good idea? We would have said probably maybe you want to invest your time someplace else. That isn't very sensible.
Wow.
And this is a great illustration of the fact that you shouldn't pay too much attention to theorists for things like this. You should really just go out and look. The universe is stranger than we can imagine. It'll teach us things all the time. And that's in fact what happened here. We're very fortunate that our observational colleagues did not listen to our opinions as to what's promising to look for. Jane Greaves over in the UK had also read some of the papers that we had back in the 90s that had suggested that phosphine was biogenic here on Earth. She'd seen that it was, you could astronomically detect it because it had been detected in the atmospheres of Jupiter and Saturn.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so she's like, why not look on Venus? Yeah. And so she just went out and looked because she's like, I can do this measurement. Why don't I do it?
Wow.
And she found it. So it's a perfect example of serendipitous kind of just observer-led science, which is how science advances so often.
Wow, that's really cool.
So do you know if the amounts detected on Venus are sufficient to have been detected on an exoplanet much further away?
Oh, God, no. Yeah, we tested that one rigorously. If you gave us a telescope if you give us like trillions of dollars in a couple of decades, we could build a telescope that would be big enough to, in space, that would be big enough to look for phosphine in an exoplanet atmosphere. But there's no way anything we have coming online in the next decade or two could have looked for it in an exoplanet atmosphere. You need very high concentrations.
Wow.
So at least in the concentrations we're seeing on Venus, what about the amounts of phosphine that you see on Earth?
Oh, it's even harder here. Because here we have a lot of oxygen in our atmosphere, and that oxygen loves to, its products like OH radical love to react with phosphine. So here on Earth, it's present, I think, much lower concentrations, parts per trillion or so.
Oh, wow.
It's a little bit more stable in the atmosphere of Venus.
So for some reason, I was understanding that the thing that led, I believe, Dr. Greaves to decide to search for phosphine was because it was the hope that it would be a valid biosignature to look for on exoplanets. And it sounds like maybe that isn't necessarily the main motivation here.
I think there are two separate things. I think Jane was focused in the solar system specifically.
Okay.
And it was our team out of MIT that was focused on the exoplanet application case.
Okay. So what would it take for an exoplanet to be able to have enough detectable phosphine for us to be able to detect it?
That is the topic of my next paper, but in very brief, as we discussed it in our earlier paper, the one that came out the first part of this year, it needs to be a primary product of the biosphere. What I mean by that is there's some gases, our biosphere, our planet views, the life on our planet views as a whole, really likes to produce a lot of. For example, one gas it likes to produce a lot of is oxygen. If life on an exoplanet produced phosphine in a way that life on our planet produces oxygen, then with some caveats and limitations, and some caveats and some assumptions, then and only then could phosphine accumulate to the concentrations required for it to become detectable. Wow. So we're talking about a totally different biosphere. We're not talking about Earth 2.0.
Right.
We're talking about smelly Earth, like super weird Earth, also toxic Earth, because phosphine is both toxic and smelly. So this is not a habitable environment for life like ours, oxygen-breathing life.
Mm-hmm.
It might be more symptomatic of life as it was on Earth billions of years ago, prior to the emergence of oxygen utilizing life.
Oh, wow.
So in terms of discovering something on the historical path that Earth took to get to where it is today in terms of life on Earth, we could be detecting some earlier stages of a planet that has life that could potentially evolve into something like we see here, but is in a much earlier stage.
You're talking about if we detect phosphine on an exoplanet?
Yes.
Yes, I would definitely, if I saw phosphine on an exoplanet and we could rule out some of those false positive mechanisms, mm-hmm. like some of the weirder stuff, then I would start to think that I would be very surprised to find significant amount of oxygen there. And if we, I would kind of start really wondering, well, maybe there's some kind of weird bias here there or something like that.
Interesting.
Actually, one of the things that this discovery is kind of teaching us, completely independent of the question of life in any sense, is the idea that you might have rocky planets out there whose atmospheres are phosphorus rich. You know, almost all of our models of rocky planet atmospheres, and I want to say none, exclude phosphorus-bearing gases from their models, because we just don't assume there will be a lot of them. And that's because here on Earth, phosphorus is very, very precious. Phosphorus is the limiting micronutrient in the ocean in terms of biological productivity. Mm-hmm. If you want to make your ocean more productive, dump some phosphorus in, and everything else will follow. And so the assumption has always been that in other planets, particularly habitable planets, phosphorus will be similarly rare. And why would life waste it by dumping it into the atmosphere? How would it get up into the atmosphere? And what Venus might be teaching us is that we have to think about the possibility that rocky planets are their atmospheres can be phosphorus rich, which opens up a whole new kind of observational ballgame and a whole new chemical ballgame. It means we have a lot more kind of chemical things to think about for these planets' atmospheres.
Wow. That is so cool. So
yeah, that's one of the things I want to emphasize. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no, cool. Go ahead.
Is that I think a lot of folks have focused on the potential biogenic interpretation, and that's very exciting, but completely independent of that. The very fact that you have a lot of phosphorus species in the atmosphere of this rocky planet is something to become excited on its own, because it's kind of opening up this whole new vista of thinking about the atmospheres of these rocky terrestrial planets.
Wow.
So it's possible that the life that may potentially be on Venus would be maybe breathing phosphine gas versus oxygen?
If there's putative life on Venus, it would be sufficiently weird that I don't think we have any sense of what it's doing or why. I should emphasize here that we talk about the clouds of Venus being habitable, but they're actually an incredibly hostile environment. No life as we know it here on Earth can survive there. They're incredibly acidic, way more acidic than any environment that we are aware of here on Earth.
Oh, wow.
They're very low water. There's very little water available for things to live on. And so we honestly don't know the biochemistry. It's hard to even speculate as to the biochemistry of what's producing, if there's biology there, why it would be generating phosphine.
Right.
It'd be kind of weird to imagine it breathing in the phosphine, because it's also kind of weird to imagine why it would be dumping it back out. I would kind of hesitate away from speculating too much about the biochemistry of a putative Venusian biosphere. That's like too many degrees of crazy. My old advisors used to say that you're allowed 2 degrees of crazy. You're allowed 1 degree of crazy, no more than one. Because if you allow 2 degrees of crazy, then you can make your data fit whatever explanation you want.
Right, you're building a house of
gotcha.
Crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. So you want to step very carefully and very slowly. And right now we already have two extraordinary claims out there. One, that phosphine is present in the atmosphere of Venus. And then the other claim, which is that with the mechanisms that we are currently aware of, we can't explain it. So we want to focus on those two first. That's what I would focus on first, is really carefully critiquing and analyzing that.
So what are the next steps then in terms of basically ruling out some of these potential theories for what is producing the phosphine?
That's a really great question. So the first thing to do, there's kind of two parallel tracks. Mm-hmm. The first is observational. We want to make sure that phosphine is really there. We want to make sure, and the reason we want to be careful about that is that we've only detected one kind of fingerprint of phosphine. So as a reminder for your guests, all these different gases in planets' atmospheres have certain spectral fingerprints. By what I mean by that is they absorb light at particular wavelengths. Mm. And the pattern of absorption is characteristic of each gas. It's unique to each gas. The gold standard of detecting gases in the atmospheres of the other planets is to detect multiple fingerprints. Mm-hmm. For phosphine, spectroscopically, we've only detected one fingerprint.
Oh.
So ideally, you'd like to find more than one fingerprint.
Interesting.
Now, we've done some preliminary efforts at doing this already, but it's really hard to do because the atmosphere of Venus is really thick. And up in the upper atmosphere, which is easy to observe, phosphine, we also expect to be destroyed very rapidly. So we're limited in how deep we can go. And it's been hard until these papers came out to kind of request the telescope time to do that.
Is that getting easier?
It might be a little bit easier now.
Okay.
So that's step one, is further follow-up observations and to make sure that phosphine is really there. Another thing that can be done in parallel is independent reanalysis of our data set. And our data, we've made them all public. And I do know there's other groups that are doing that. So we should have a second look at the data, more multiple sets of eyes looking at the data as well. A really clever idea was proposed by a group that put a preprint out, I think at the beginning of last week, which was the United States sent a mission to Venus several decades ago, the mm-hmm. Pioneer mission. Mm-hmm. It dropped an instrument that went through the atmosphere and tried to measure the composition of the atmosphere. And they did something in retrospect was a guinea. They went through that data and tried to look for evidence, if they could see evidence of phosphine at any place in the atmosphere or not, if they could rule it out one way or the other. And they claim that they detect evidence in these data completely independently from the spectral measurements of phosphine being present there as well. So I think that's worth looking into as well, because that's kind of an independent in situ measurement of phosphine. And they also find it at the same altitudes that we find it at.
So this data has been here for decades and nobody yes. just thought to look for phosphine specifically in that data set.
That's correct. Yeah. Wow. So this is one of the questions we asked for, like, what else is in there? And they're like, it turns out a lot of people just haven't looked at it. Like, people looked for the things that were present in relatively high abundance. They had their kind of list of things they wanted to check out. And then no one really looked for things like phosphine, because like, why would you look for it there? Why would it ever be there? But anyhow, that's a kind of clever study of kind of independent validation that needs to be done.
Yeah.
So step one is making sure that phosphine is there. If the mass spec results bear out, then that would make me feel a lot more confident. It would really justify a follow-up mission. Mm. Now let's make the assumption that phosphine is there. What could be producing it? For that, I think a lot of people are again jumping straight to the mission. First and foremost, there's a lot of work we can do right here on Earth with the existing labs and facilities we have. We need to measure the chemical kinetics, how fast phosphine and its daughter products react with different molecular gases as a function of temperature and pressure over a broad range of parameter space. So we need to do lab measurements for a lot of basic chemistry first. These are measurements that we could have done anytime in the past few decades, but there was no good reason to, because why would you care about phosphine? I mean, its main commercial use here on Earth is like killing rats. Like, you don't really need a lot of sophistication. You just need to make it and then go kill the rats. But now what we hope, you have a little bit more of a reason to study the detailed chemistry. And then once we've studied that chemistry, we can incorporate it into our photochemical models. And we can really kind of figure out how weird is this? Are there mechanisms that we can somehow come up with to produce the phosphine abiotically?
Right.
If we continue to not be able to produce it abiotically, then there becomes reason. Then you start to have motivation for a mission to go and try to characterize what the phosphine production mechanism is. I'm sure by then we'll have hypotheses and possibilities. And then we can construct instruments to look for signatures that differentiate between those possibilities so that we can rule them in or rule them out.
Are you familiar with the Bepi Colombo mission that is currently going to be doing two flybys of Venus in 2021, I believe?
Yes, we are. We are in touch with that team about the possibility of looking for phosphine there using their instruments. The problem is those instruments weren't really designed for that. They're still going to give it a shot, but they're not super optimistic. But who knows? We weren't really expecting anyone to pull anything out of the mass spec data from the Pioneer mission either, but apparently they did.
Wow.
That hasn't been through the peer review process yet, so let's treat that with this grain of salt.
Of course.
We called them and let's see what happens. Let the peer review process happen.
Who is that team that's doing the Pioneer work?
It's led by, I forget the first author's name, it's Rakesh something at Cal Poly. I can, in an email afterwards, I can send you their preprint and you can contact them.
That'd be lovely.
Thank you.
Oh man. So I know you said that phosphine is really great for helping life on our oceans and what have you. Is it something
Phosphorus, not phosphine. Phosphine is murderous to our biosphere. Phosphorus is great.
Okay.
So if we're seeing phosphines in Venus, does that lead to the potential of seeing phosphorus on Venus as well?
That is, in fact, that is absolutely correct. We expect to see different forms of phosphorus on Venus, and we expect, even in the most extreme scenario, phosphine to be a relatively trace form of phosphorus. We still expect most of that phosphorus to be present in an oxidized form, in the form of what's called phosphate.
Okay. Is it something that could potentially be mined and brought back to, I don't know, help revitalize our oceans?
If you wanted more phosphorus in our oceans, a better way to do that would just be to mine in our crust here.
Mm. Oh,
we have a ton of phosphorus here. It's just not in the oceans.
Ah.
yeah. getting it from Venus would be incredibly expensive and not really worth it.
Gotcha.
Wow, that is so interesting. So when it comes to, you know, the potential for this to be life, you're talking about we need to first do some research here on Earth to confirm that, yes, this is phosphine that we're seeing, confirm the observations, to really try to hammer out whether or not there are other abiotic paths for this phosphine to be being produced mm-hmm. that we weren't previously aware of. And then we're talking about potentially sending a mission to Venus to get a better look and to really kind of figure out what's going on there. What kind of time frame are you talking about here before a potential mission like that could be launched?
Well, there's a lot of debate here. I think I lean a little bit towards emphasizing the role of laboratories and stuff like that. I really want to get things right before we send things to space. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say that. I prefer exhausting all of our options here on Earth before going to space, because space-based missions are really expensive.
Right.
There's a big opportunity cost to the scientific community. And so in my opinion, we need to be really careful about this. And, you know, we can better design instruments once we have a better sense of the fundamentals of the chemistry and physics of the molecules we're interested in. Mm-hmm. But other folks have different perspectives. And one of their perspectives is kind of like Jane, we should just go and look and see what we can see. And then maybe that'll be much more strongly constraining than maybe that'll end up short circuiting the process and saving you a decade worth of lab-based work here on Earth.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And so there actually are a lot of folks that feel that way. I know of at least one private actor, one private company whose goal is to send a probe to Venus in the next like few years. They were doing this independent of the whole phosphine thing.
Is this a company you can name?
They're totally fine with my naming them. I just forgot their name right now. Right. Sorry.
Send us an email.
Yeah, I'll send it to you an email. Yeah, but so yeah, that's been an open objective of theirs for a while. Mm-hmm. They do microsatellites here on Earth, and for a long time they've wanted to send a microsat to Venus.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
There's also the recently announced initiative from the Breakthrough Foundation,
right,
called Breakthrough Venus. And that's also something who, in a relatively short time scale, that is a decade or so, I think, is that a decade or less is my understanding, wants to send something relatively quick and fast to Venus to see to kind of characterize the information about the habitability of the cloud deck.
Is this a new
Is
this a new breakthrough initiative that's been announced as a result of this discovery?
It is a new breakthrough initiative. It was announced just in the aftermath of this discovery, but it was started independent of this discovery. Okay. In other words, the foundation was interested in the question of life in the Venusian clouds well before they knew about phosphine.
Wow. So, okay. But that's interesting, because that's an organization that is maybe a little bit more agile than governmental organizations. I believe it was started by Yuri Milner, is backed by Stephen Hawking. And they have this incredible initiative to try to go and basically take pictures of planets around other stars by sending tiny satellites out to them. So they propose these crazy kind of missions that you would never get a government to sign off on, but they're able to do it because they have this private funding and they're able to pivot and adjust to science as it comes out. And now that they maybe had this idea for, you know, looking in the clouds of Venus, all of a sudden, boom, it's a huge priority and they can jump on that right away.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. One of the interesting things about them is that, I don't know about private organizations in general, is that their risk tolerance can be a lot higher. If you're a taxpayer-funded organization, NASA is very good about trying to intentionally pursue risk, but you have to be very responsible with other people's money, you know?
Yes.
Right.
You have to be responsible stewards of the public purse. I'm not saying private institutions are spendthrift, but I'm saying because it's their money, they can afford to have a slightly higher risk tolerance.
Right.
And the same thing that holds true in stocks holds true here. If you take on more risk, your odds of going bust go up, but your potential return, your expected returns also go up.
Right.
So that's an edge that they can kind of navigate.
That's really cool. So if we do potentially like think that there might be life on Venus, which obviously very low probability at this point.
Hypothesis of last resort. We can't rule on the probability either.
Right.
Hypothesis of last resort.
Got you.
What kind of like what size life forms would we potentially be looking at? Would it be like microscopic life forms? Oh, yeah. Okay.
It would definitely, like, I can't imagine it being anything other than like a bug, like a bacterium or something like that. And that's because in order
when
to
you
make
say, wait, hang on, when you say bug though, you mean bacteria. You don't mean a bug crawling around.
Yeah, sorry,
at our
level. No, yeah. I mean bacterium. Anything multicellular. The thing about multicellular life is that it's quite energetically taxing.
Yeah.
Mm. And Venus, at least for biochemistry, as we understand it. So this is why I'm talking multiple degrees of crazy, right?
Right.
Like, if for biochemistry, as we understand it, the environment on Venus should be so hostile, even in the comparatively habitable cloud deck, that kind of our naive expectation going in is that it should be taking everything it's got just to exist.
Right.
Like it shouldn't be able to deal with something as complex as assembling into multicellular life. That would just be That would be crazy. That would be very extraordinary.
So you think even like single-celled life would be more likely? Like eukaryotes and what are they called here?
Prokaryotes. Eukaryotes, prokaryotes, archaea, something like that. I would even say that eukaryotes are too complicated. I would expect something prokaryotic or archaean or something like that.
Got you. So similar to the very first forms of life that arose here on Earth before they developed into multicellular organisms.
That would be my expectation, yes.
Got it. Wow.
That's still really cool, though.
Of putative life, which I want to emphasize. Yes. I don't want to be sensationalist here.
Right.
That remains a hypothesis of last resort. We have a lot of abiotic stuff to look at first.
Do you feel that the media is being too sensationalist with this already?
You know, it's hard to tell because I've tried to avoid going on Twitter and stuff too much. It's a very energetic place these days.
Yes.
Little, yeah.
Certainly the folks I've interacted with like yourselves have been quite measured and quite careful. And I really respect that. And I'm really grateful for that because it's a really great partnership. I think that one of the things someone pointed out, even some of the tabloids, which can be expected to sometimes be quite extreme, have been extremely measured and been like, you know, this is not evidence of life. This is something weird and interesting and it's worth following up on.
Yeah.
But in that sense, I'm actually really excited about this because it bodes really well for the search for life on exoplanets. Mm. So I'm really excited about this discovery for a different reason, which is that it is basically a dry run, a test run, of the entire intellectual machinery, which we're going to look for life on exoplanets. So as a reminder for your listeners, exoplanets are planets orbiting other stars. Missions in the last decade have revealed Earth-sized planets, maybe habitable Earth planets around these planets, around these stars to be relatively common. And it's a major goal of NASA and the ESA and other institutions to search them for signs of life. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to look for something weird in their atmosphere, something we don't expect to be there. And then we're going to try to figure out ways to make it abiotically. And then if we don't find a way to make it abiotically, then we're going to say, well, maybe there's something alive there.
Right.
And Venus, this is exactly what we're getting, the process that we've started with this phosphine on Venus thing. We found something weird there. And now we're going to try our darndest to A, prove that it's not there, and B, figure out if it is there some way to make it abiotically.
Right.
And if that holds up, if that all holds up and we decide that, you know, we've really ruled out everything else we can think of, we think that the most conservative answer might be life. In the case of Venus, we can actually go look.
That's amazing.
We can't do that for exoplanets, but you can go and check. And so you can validate this entire intellectual machinery that we're building on.
That's incredible.
That's so cool.
Did you at any point think that that was ever going to be possible within our own solar system to be able to validate our machinery like this? Or were we always assumed to be kind of stabbing in the dark a little bit because whatever we discover on exoplanets, we can only really try to rule out here. We can't really ever validate.
That's exactly correct. Yeah, you've hit the nail. You and your colleague have hit the nail on the head of kind of the big criticism of life search on exoplanets, which is that we're going to have so little information. We're not going to even get, we're only going to get one pixel worth of data. We're not going to be able to resolve the planet. Mm-hmm. We'll just have one core spectrum, maybe some time variable data if we're lucky. From that data, how can we really make a strong inference regarding the presence of life? And what we concluded is that it was always going to be probabilistic. It was always going to be like, 80% chance it's life, 20% chance this is a super, super, super weird planet. And one of the approaches, there people have been trying to think of creative ways of getting around this. One idea had been, well, maybe we're going to survey 100 potentially habitable planets and 50 of them are going to display the same type of potential biosignature. Mm-hmm. And we'll be able to say that it's super unlikely that 50 planets are all super weird. So the balance of probability is that at least some of them are alive. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, the idea that maybe we can like exercise this machinery right here in the solar system is really exciting.
Wow. That is so cool to hear.
That is really awesome. So how do you think this is changing the direction of your research and or the direction of like the research around Venus moving forward?
That's a really great question. In a sense, this isn't changing our work very much because this is kind of where we were going originally. We were very interested in anoxic systems and we were interested in kind of walking the path less traveled in a sense. We were trying to like, different groups have different paradigms about how they approach things. Some groups have the approach that we have one example of a living planet, so we really need to focus on that and kind of extrapolate from that. Other groups have the approach of reasoning from saying, look, everything has to obey a certain fundamental chemical laws. Let's be independent of Earth and try to trace that. So there's different approaches there. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of aligns with our approach, which is more of the avoiding terracentricity approach a little bit. So
wow. If I may just try to rephrase that. So basically, rather than just looking for the type of life that we know exists here on Earth, you want to be able to look for any type of life that could exist, even if it exists in ways that we can't fathom here on Earth. And this is a method of doing the latter. Is that?
Yeah. I wouldn't say completely independent. We want to be somewhat connected because, again, if you, you're allowed 2 degrees, you're allowed 1 degree of crazy.
Right.
Right.
You either claim life that's totally different from what you have on Earth, or you can claim a remote detection of life, but you can't do both. Okay. So, for example, phosphine we're focused on because it is produced by some life here on Earth.
Okay.
If there was a gas that we argued, well, maybe life could produce this metabolically, but it wasn't produced by something here on Earth, we wouldn't even propose that as an option then, because we don't have that proof positive that life generates it.
Right.
Gotcha.
But we are saying be less terracentric. Don't lose the Earth entirely.
Okay.
But mm-hmm. step back a little bit.
Okay.
We know that X gas is made on Earth in trace amounts. Maybe on some other planet it can be made in slightly higher amounts.
Interesting. Interesting. Because what you've, you know, the way that you've described this, the kind of the environment on Venus, and if this is some microscopic life form on Venus, it's something that's very different than what we know here, because we don't really know many life forms here on Earth that could survive in those conditions. Do you think that indicates that it's likely that this is in an independent generation of life that is not from the same life that founded life here on Earth?
That's another really great question. So let's assume that, so if we make the assumption that there is a biosphere there, I would not at all be confident that it's a separate instantiation of life. In fact, I would not be at all surprised if it were very deeply related to ours. And the fundamental reason for that is twofold. One is the idea that Venus and Earth are not only quite similar and quite close to each other, it's projected that Venus could have been habitable as recently as 700 or 800 million years ago. That sounds like a long time, but the planets of the solar system are 4.5 billion years old.
Right.
So Venus could have been habitable almost as long as Earth was.
Right.
And if that were the case, another thing that we know is that all the rocky planets in our solar system should be exchanging material with each other. We found meteorites from Mars here on Earth. We expect meteorites from Earth to have gone to Mars. And we expect the same to have been true with Venus, between Venus and Earth as well. There have been some calculations done about that, particularly before it went into its runaway greenhouse and while it had a habitable surface and a less thick atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And there's been some really great work showing that it's not completely implausible that life could survive between the two. And you might have had I think hundreds of thousands to millions of tons of materials transferred between these objects over the history of the solar system.
I love the name for this. Do you know what it is?
I don't think I do.
Panspermia. Did I get that right?
I would be more specific and say lithopanspermia.
That's a new one for me. What does lithopanspermia mean?
Panspermia is the idea that life is transferred from world to world and diffuses throughout the universe. It's it could be exogenous. Mm-hmm. Lithopanspermia is a specification of that idea. It's specifically saying maybe life travels from one planet to another in rocks. That's the litho part of that.
Got you.
And it's based on the specific observation that Martian meteorites exist. And their interiors never go through very, don't necessarily go through sterilizing conditions. For example, they don't really exceed temperatures like about 40, 50 Celsius or so. So if you have a bacterial spore, it could possibly survive.
Right. That's so interesting.
It's based on this very physical observation.
What would it take to verify whether or not this form of life is independent from the life that arose here on Earth?
Several things. First off, if you can detect it and if it, so... Unfortunately, you can't do it remotely. You would need to, you need to culture this putative life and understand it a little bit better. So let's suppose it uses a different biochemistry than us. So it doesn't use DNA and RNA. It uses some other classes of molecules entirely. That would be a pretty good guess, although not a guarantee, that it's unrelated. If it uses a different structural molecule, so instead of carbon, it uses silicon or something like that. I would feel very confident saying that's totally unrelated. If it uses a different solvent, if it doesn't use water, it uses something else instead, like sulfuric acid. That's also a good guess that it's unrelated. Or if on the other extreme, if it actually does use DNA and RNA and stuff, and you can do a phylogenetic study on it, I don't even know if you can do that. Actually, let's disfavor that. I don't know if you can do that, so I won't consider it.
So in all these examples, though, do you need an actual sample return mission in order to do it?
Most likely, yes.
Okay.
You would want a sample return mission of some kind, I would guess. I guess if people are doing really great things with miniaturization these days, so if you can somehow miniaturize and automate a wet lab and send it to Venus, it may be able to do stuff. But at least with the technology as it exists currently, I think you would want to call it plan for sample return,
right?
Which would be really hard. So don't hold your breath on that one.
But it sounds like this is all stuff that's going to be at least doable within our lifetimes, if not within the next decade.
Yes. But let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Right.
We could find other measurements which which show that phosphine is not there, right. In which case Venus is still cool, but we shouldn't focus on phosphine as much. We could figure out some kind of abiotic synthesis mechanism. Mm-hmm. My personal bias, I like to go for the lab work first. Yes. I like to go start from here on Earth. So that's where I would start first.
Yeah. The reason I ask these questions, though, just for our viewers to follow along, is I'm fascinated with the concept of the Fermi paradox. This paradox where we look up into the stars, we discover that not only are the stars numerous, but now we're discovering there's planets that are rocky planets around, I believe, something like 50% of the stars we're finding. Mm-hmm. So basically, life, if it's possible, should be plentiful. And why do we not see evidence of life that has arisen to the level that we're at and even further than us? Because once you get to our point, it's not going to take long for, you know, in the millions of years spectrum, it's not going to take long for Earth life to be potentially traveling out to the stars. So why don't we see it? So one of the biggest questions is life plentiful? And the only way to really answer that is to find out, do we see other forms of life that have arisen independently from the forms of life here on Earth? So we find other forms of life in our solar system that are from the same original genesis of life. That doesn't necessarily give us an independent form of life. Exactly, it doesn't tell us a whole lot. So if we can find a form of life that arose independently from the life here on Earth, that is huge for our understanding of whether or not life should be plentiful within the rest of the universe. So how excited are you for that potential?
If we can find an independent origin of life here in our solar system, I would be immensely excited because, like you pointed out, to me that would signal that the universe is crawling with life.
Right.
It would also make me feel a lot better about the long-term prognosis for our species. The problem you're referring to, as you're probably aware, is referred to as the Great Filter.
Yes.
The sky should be full if you assume everything is a hunky-dory of people shouting at us and being like, "Come join us! The party's the water's just fine out here." So what's causing them to stop being here? The optimistic explanation is that we're in a zoo. They have a prime directive. That'd be great. Because the other explanation is that there's something that prevents life, biospheres like ours and life like ours from evolving.
Right.
That could be that abiogenesis is hard, which would be sad from the perspective of finding life elsewhere. So I hope that's not true.
Abiogenesis meaning the original formation of life.
Yes. Right. Yeah. The arising of life from non-life.
Right.
Or it could mean that intelligent life is common, but it has a tendency to nuke itself, which would be very sad. And we don't want that to be the case.
Do you have a favorite theory for what the Great Filter might be?
I don't actually. So the problem is like you have too many, there's so many degrees of freedom in there, so many kind of what I've been colloquially referring to as degrees of crazy that you can make almost anything fit whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I'm actually very interested in this. I think there's a lot of really great work being done at Origins of Life, and I kind of hope that within our lifetimes, hopefully, and hopefully much sooner, I would really hope in the next few decades, we will make a synthesis of artificial life in the lab. That would be my dream hope.
Wow.
And if we can do that, then if we can get a handle on those mechanisms, we can constrain how hard or how easy that is, and so then we can constrain one of the big terms in that Fermi paradox. And that might seem overly ambitious, but like when the Fermi paradox was formulated, I don't think anyone could have guessed that we would constrain the frequency of habitable planets around other stars and that it would be this optimistic, this high.
Yes.
So I think figuring out how hard or how easy it is to start life is an ambitious thing, but it's something we can do empirically. It's something that a lot of folks are working very hard on here on Earth. So I have optimism that we can solve that problem as well.
That is incredible. So while this is not yet evidence of life, we have not been able to rule it out as a possibility. Just that simple fact, does that change the amount of research, the amount of excitement within the scientific community, and maybe the amount of funding that is going to be directed towards answering this question when it comes to this specific discovery on Venus?
I certainly hope that these observations and these determinations, if they hold up, will encourage investment in what I view to be underinvested in parts of science at this point. I think that I think that we've been doing really great things with our planetary programs, and I love them. I love them all, but I think Venus, to some degree, has been underinvested in, and I think that's a little bit of a challenge because, in some sense, it's prototypical of the planets we expect to find most easily around other stars, And so these are the kind of like so-called exo-Venuses or super-Venuses. Mm-hmm. And that's because they're just observationally easy to detect and then to characterize, to measure.
What makes them observationally easy to detect?
They tend to orbit closer to their star.
Right.
So you get more so-called transits. They're also can be a little bit hotter, so you get more signal that way as well. Puffier atmospheres, all that kind of stuff. There's a whole bunch of technical stuff that folds into it.
Okay.
So we're gonna probably end up measuring a lot of those and detecting a lot of those, but we haven't really characterized the touchstone for those in our solar system, Venus. So I think that there's a really robust case to be made completely independent of phosphine for understanding Venus better. And if this helps invest in Venus a little bit, I would be really grateful for that. Similarly, I hope this will encourage investment in understanding the chemical systems in the absence of oxygen. We have a lot of really amazing work that's been done in the presence of oxygen because we live in an oxygenated world. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense for quality of life purposes and practical applications. That's what you want to understand. But even here on Earth, for about half of its history, there was no oxygen, no measurable amounts of oxygen present. And so if we find a planet out there that's like early Earth, or that's like Venus or Mars are today, we won't have as good a sense of their chemical processes. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we can invest a little bit in understanding of chemistry and biochemistry in the absence of oxygen a little bit better.
So what would you say is your favorite thing or the most exciting thing to you personally about this discovery?
To me, it's just the fact that we found something weird there. Now we get to figure out what's going on.
Yes.
This sounds facetious, but it's something that I've thought about since graduate school. So you're probably familiar with the Galileo Life Search mission, mm-hmm. which was a clever idea when the Galileo probe on its way to Jupiter swung by Earth. They targeted its instruments on Earth and tried to see if they could. They pretended that they were alien scientists, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and tried to see if they could detect life on Earth just from those remote detections. Mm-hmm. And their conclusion was, we found something weird here. It's probably life. And their conclusion was, based on what we understand about geology and based on the measurements we've made of this planet, the balance of probability is that it's life. Therefore, the idea that there's life on Earth is currently the hypothesis to refute. And that's what we've always thought we were going to do with these exoplanets. And now we get to do it right here in the solar system. We get to go through that and test that machinery. And maybe we'll learn some lessons we can use when we try to do that for exoplanets, which will be much harder.
Right. That is so, so exciting. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to come and speak with us today to share your knowledge about this discovery, to share your experience with it. And hopefully we can excite more people to get involved in this kind of research and pursue all of these different ways that these different fractals of the tree of knowledge that we need to explore in order to be able to figure out, does life exist in the universe and how are we going to be able to find it? And that is just so exciting to hear that, we're doing it already here in our solar system, which I don't think anybody was expecting, at least not yet. I know that there are a lot of ideas for Europa and Enceladus and other moons of Jupiter and Saturn. But I think that our excitement about Mars and Venus were kind of at a low point, right? Recently was my understanding. And this has totally switched that, totally put it on its head. So
I think all the objects in our solar system are wonderful, and I think all of them should be studied in as much depth as we can. I love all the planets, yes. But I do think that there's a good reason to be made for taking a second look at Venus.
That is so exciting. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time. And is there anywhere that you would like to direct people to find more information on your work and what you're doing?
Not particularly. We all have websites. They can Google me if they'd like. If they'd like to look at the papers, we post the Nature Astronomy paper is, I believe, public, and I think the rest of the papers we've done, like the interpretation paper, where we try to work out what are the different things that could make phosphine. That's a preprint of that is not publicly available.
Awesome. Yeah, we're going to link.
If you want to take,
we're going to link all of that in the description for the show.
Yeah, and if you're radio, if you want to play around with some radio data, those data are also public. So go wild.
Wow, I love that. I love that.
Is there anything else that you wanted to share with our listeners, or anything else that you might want to leave us with?
Not particularly. I would just say that a lot of the work that went into this ultimately received funding from the U.S. taxpayer and taxpayer in other countries as well. So I hope that this is reasonable return on your investment.
Yes. This is actually a really good question. We're going into the elections in November. We've done a few episodes on the elections. When it comes to investment in science, if that is a priority for a voter, what recommendations would you have for doing research on candidates, for trying to understand which candidates to vote for when it comes to voting for candidates that are going to be better for science?
I don't have a good answer to that question right now, unfortunately. I haven't thought about it in a lot of detail, so I'm afraid I can't give an answer to that.
Fair enough. We're going to spend more time thinking about that one, because that's something that's very important to us, because we want to see more research like this happening, and we want to make sure that the funding for it is happening. So
absolutely,
maybe that'll be a future episode for us, and we'll send you a link when we get that.
That'd be great. I'd love to learn more about it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you again, Dr. Ranjan. And thank you for the work that you're doing. This is so exciting, so inspiring. We have already heard people talking about this discovery as being the discovery of the year, if not the decade, and has the potential for being one of the greatest discoveries of all time. If just one of the potentials for what this could be happens to come true. And we know that it isn't that yet, but still good reason to be excited. So yes, thank you again.
This was an absolute pleasure. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. And thank you again for coming on the show.
You as well. I hope you have a really great time.
All right.
Thank you. Have a great one. So that was Dr. Sukrit Ranjan. We had such an amazing time interviewing him, and we obviously were very excited to ask a ton of great questions. Let us know what you think in the comments, if there was more questions that you wanted to ask, or if you wanted to ask questions of potentially some of our next guests coming down the line on the same topic. Let us know. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you like the episode. Give us a like. Give us a subscribe. You can follow us on YouTube. Check out our website at funtimeprogram.com, or follow us on whatever app you use to get your podcasts.
Thanks for checking this out, guys. We are so excited about this particular discovery. I think it's awesome to hear how this is going to play out over the next couple of years. So we're going to be staying tuned to the work that is being done to follow up with this discovery. And we'll hopefully be doing many more episodes about that and about other things coming up in space, because we're
kind of space nerds.
We're a little bit of the space nerds. And space is the new frontier. It is happening in our lifetime. It's no longer the dead era of the post-moon missions where nothing was happening in space, or at least not as much. Now we have SpaceX. We have NASA doing amazing things. We have the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency. Even China is doing interesting stuff, although they don't really tell anybody about it.
Don't forget about Space Force.
Space Force. Oh my God, what was the great Space Force joke today? I've already forgotten it. Somebody was talking about how Mark Kelly was giving Republicans their first taste of Space Force when he booted McSally off into space at their debate last night.
Oh, so good.
We're also excited to have an astronaut in the Senate coming up very soon.
I mean, if you happen to be in Arizona, vote for Senator Mark Kelly so you can have an astronaut as your senator.
Yes. So thank you guys again for checking out this episode. We will be back with more science episodes, more culture episodes, more society episodes,
and hopefully more kink episodes. What's up?
We got some interesting things coming up. So definitely stay tuned and check us out wherever you listen to podcasts or on YouTube. And thanks again for watching.
Have a great one.
Bye.